Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this event, which I have the privilege of chairing. My name is Sumila Lankin. I'm an associate professor here at the International Relations Department of the London School of Economics. I have the privilege of introducing three distinguished speakers who are all in their distinct capacity experts on Ukraine, either in their capacity as policymakers or as academic experts. So today we have Ulrika Hauer, who is the team leader for political process with the European Commission Support Group for Ukraine and is kind of intimately involved on the policymaking side or policy implementation side in the European Commission vis-a-vis Ukraine. We have Professor Andrew Wilson, who, as you know, is a foremost expert on Ukrainian politics, who has written a number of books on Ukraine, including most recently one published with Yale University Press called Ukrainian Crisis, What It Means for the West. Did I get it accurately?
Ukraine Crisis.
Yes. And we have Serhiy Leshenko, who is the foremost expert on Ukrainian corruption and oligarch, who's worked for nearly 15 years for Ukrainskaya Pravda, and who is now also an MP in the Ukraine. So we'll start with Andrew, and then we're followed by Ulrika, and then by Serhiy's presentation. And we'll give each presenter about 10-15 minutes, followed by, yes, there are lots of topics we could discuss when it comes to Ukraine, but 10-15 minutes, and followed by Q&A session, and I'll try to do my best in moderating the questions and timekeeping. Thank you. So the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much. I should also add that I am LSC alumnus. I did my PhD here back in the 90s, before this building was taken over. So it's a pleasure to be back. Serhiy and I have both contributed to this booklet, What Does Ukraine Think? It's free, so please pick it up if you haven't already. But I will try and answer the, make my normal mistake of trying to answer the question first, and then I'll just add in a few words to plug that book at the end. So first of all, looking at the title we have, Crisis in Ukraine is still not quite right. I wrote a book called Ukraine Crisis, but only because the publisher wanted me to. It was their choice of title, not mine. Normally I'm quite inventive with titles, but I went with theirs this time. And my Ukrainian friends quite rightly don't like it. It depicts Ukraine as the problem, the victim, and the sole arena of crisis. So even crisis in Ukraine, although better, is not exact. This is a crisis about many things. First and foremost, obviously, about Russia, but also about the EU, the West in general, our foreign policy credibility, etc. So the first part of this evening's title is still a little inexact. What does Ukraine want from the EU? Well, although a lot of the discussion is still about abstract things like membership or a membership perspective, I don't think that's really the heart of the problem at the moment. What Ukraine wants is a Ukraine policy to go alongside a Russia policy. It sees the latter but doesn't really see the former. Russia policy is more obvious but still could be more robust from the Ukrainian point of view. So yes, we have sanctions renewed for another 6 months by all indication. That's good, but doing it on a 6-monthly basis kicks the can down the road a little. On the other hand, you have the Riga summit, which kind of capped a process of taking one step back. Its declaration was phrased in less grandiose terms about welcoming all. The previous declaration had welcomed all steps to moving closer together. This was a bit more circumspect. There have been sort of nomenclature revisions formalising this. Ukraine is also somewhat concerned about the constant German process of reassuring Russia, although there are indications that the talks on the EU-Ukraine trade agreement, which were going round and round in circles as Russia demanded more and more reassurance for no plausible reason, are at least finally predicted to end in the final introduction of the trade agreement in January. So Ukraine would like Russia policy to be more robust. What would an ideal type EU-Ukraine policy consist of? Well, in no particular order, but certainly first would be money. Constant comparisons to Greece are, we hear them a lot, but they are worth making. The EU has given, I don't know the exact figures, representatives of the FT will correct me, nearly $300 billion-ish?
Dollars.
Yeah, US dollars. With very little hope of seeing much of that back. $2 billion has been offered to Ukraine. Higher figures are really re-additions of older policies. And there are ways of setting up assistance to Ukraine which would actually involve less risk of financial loss than has happened with the EU and Greece. One short-term proposal, for example, is for a foreign exchange swap. Although IMF assistance has doubled Ukraine's foreign exchange reserves to the princely total of about $9 billion US. That is an extremely precarious amount. Anders Sasland and others have proposed that European central banks and the ECB itself lend or set up a kind of swap facility which, if it works properly, would never actually have to leave European capitals or even be drawn on. Its purpose would simply be to expand the padding. George Soros has talked about an offshore investment fund. The point being, the adjective, the money would be held in Europe and dispersed from there to minimise corruption possibilities. So they will talk about that later. Soros has also floated the proposal of insuring political risk. It's very hard to distinguish between the political and the economic, but there is almost zero FDI into Ukraine at the moment because of various types of political risk, one of which includes military risk. But that is the key deterrent to anybody stepping foot in Ukraine at the moment. Second, and the representative of the EU will talk more about this, solidarity with reform. In key areas in particular, the legal area is the key laggard sector. There's been progress in some areas, almost none in others, and the failure to reform the procuracy and the courts when that should have been priority number one in many ways is glaringly obvious. Next, some kind of action against Russia's trade war. We don't hear much about this, but most of the damage being done to the Ukrainian economy at the moment, and GDP fell by more than 15% in the first quarter of this year. Most of that damage is not due to the direct effects of the war, which the government has calculated at about 5-6% of GDP. Exports to Russia fell by half last year and by another 60% in the first quarter of this year, because Russia is basically stopping exports with all kind of unilateral and typically bogus health and safety measures. Ukraine asks for, and I'll phrase that very carefully, because I know it will be difficult for the EU to respond, a more robust monitoring mission to go alongside, or we hear the difficulties being expressed, to go along or in addition to the OSCE, which apparently has one effect, which that most of the missile firing is at night, when the OSCE mission isn't working. So it has some effect. And lastly, bandwagoning with the USA. Part of this is about broader languages of priorities that Washington expected and still expects the EU to do more in its own backyard. But the tide is changing in Washington towards some kind of more robust response. And greater coordination with Washington would help that. Lastly, then, a word about this magnificent publication. What does Ukraine think? It's only slightly off topic because many of the key issues that I've just talked about are addressed therein. It's by the European Council on Foreign Relations, which has previously done what does China think, what does Germany think. So that means Ukraine is now a crucial, pivotal, important state, like Germany, like China. Congratulations. Second reason, though, is what Ukrainians like to call direct voice, Priami Golos. There is so much fog and propaganda surrounding events in Ukraine. There's way too much of foreigners like me talking about Ukraine, a lot of whom, not me, had no track record of knowing anything about Ukraine beforehand. So this is Ukrainian authors and experts, 11 of them, all Ukrainian nationals, talking about key issues themselves. And lastly, although this is the European Council on Foreign Relations, I smuggled in some intellectuals like Sergei and others. So it addresses some very important issues about national identity, national unity, regionalism within Ukraine, the difficulties but the possibilities of pushing reform when you are at war, and other key dilemmas. So I'd heartily recommend it, and you can also download it for free if you go to ecfr.eu. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much, Andrew. So we'll move on to Ulrike now. Okay, I'm too short for this chair, for this table. Well, good evening. Thank you, first of all, for inviting a Eurocrat to an academic debate. It's not that often that this happens. I appreciate the opportunity. I will also resist the temptation to be drawn into a discussion about the Greece issue and the comparison with Greece. I'll try to make a few points which I thought about when I actually mainly read the title and some parts of the book, which is what does Ukraine think and what do Ukrainians actually think, and how do we as EU try to respond? Do we get it right? Are we actually addressing it in the right way? And I'd like to start with, actually, by referring to a speech which the US ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, gave just a few days ago, I think about a week ago in Kiev, which I think made one point, which is very much in line of what I understood here, is that very often what is happening today in Ukraine is actually told as a story of the big geopolitical issues, East versus the West, the Eurasian Union versus the EU as models for integration, Russia versus the EU, or depending on your point of view, Russia versus the US. And in this whole story, in the end, Ukrainians get to choose either side, they're either on one side or on the other side. But they're not actually, they're rarely appearing as actors anymore, which is absurd in a way if you think that where the whole thing started was the Maidan last year. Of course, this was about Ukrainians asking for change, asking for a different, an alternative, a different perspective for their country's future, for their own future. Also famously called the Euromaidan, of course, it was about the EU, but there I agree with Andrew very much. In my view, it wasn't about membership. This wasn't about people going out and even demonstrating for a boring association agreement, and I'll come to the association agreement in a moment. And it wasn't about we want to become members of the EU, definitely not at that point in time, but it was really the EU, Europe, was in my view, was a symbol for what they wanted as being different in their own country. It was seen as an alternative, and I think that's important to keep in mind. Now,
I mentioned the association agreement. Of course, the association agreement started many, many years ago, our negotiations, but it is the main framework for our relations. It is a very lengthy, a very heavy agreement. It covers everything from political relations down to the very, very nitty-gritty of economic and sector-specific integration of Ukraine with the European Union. But it really is, beyond that, and we always hoped it could become a blueprint for domestic reforms, and that's why I do want to talk a little bit about the reform issues and how we try to support them. And of course, at the moment, the pressure on the government to deliver on reforms is huge. Now, from my own conversations with Ukrainians, very often I hear this is one last chance for Ukraine to actually get it right. I wonder if Sergei actually agrees with me on that. But definitely there's a feeling of urgency and of it has to happen now, and if it doesn't happen now, we will be in even deeper trouble than we are already. I think we also see and we would recognize that there is a political will to reform, which is definitely higher than anything we have seen before. There is a different Rada today, one representative we have here. There is a parliament today which really has sincere and serious policy debates, which wasn't the case before, so that bodes well for the success of reforms. However, despite all these positive signs and these positive steps, what is still there is the inherently weak institutions. There is still the influence of the oligarchs, which hasn't been broken. Maybe some individuals have been pushed into different corners, but I think they're maybe coming back out of there. And of course, there's in general the vested interests of the elites, be they in the administration, be that the political elites, but also the economic elites. And they remain strong, and they, of course, have not the same interest in getting Ukraine transformed into a different country. Now, on top of all this, of course, comes the war, and I'm now not going to go into the war, because A, I don't feel particularly competent to do so, but I also think I would like to focus on the reform side. So I think it is a struggle against time. It is a struggle against enormous challenges, a lot of windmills. But I also think that the war cannot be an excuse for a lack of reforms. Not because it shouldn't be, but because there is no alternative at the moment to reforms. The war cannot be won militarily. I think there's relatively broad agreement that the Ukrainian army, despite its improvements, will not be able in the current situation to fight this war or to win this war militarily. And the only way is to make Ukraine a more attractive and more resilient country for its own citizens. And that happens through reforms. That is, in a way, in my view, and I think in a lot of people, view one way towards improving at least the situation. Now, what does the EU do to support this process? We actually think we do give quite a bit of financial support. I don't want to go into the individual figures, but we have over the last 1.5-2 years mobilized about 6 billion euro, which is much more than we have, of course, for any other country outside the EU. I think that is where the comparison to Greece may not hold entirely. It may not be enough, it's definitely not enough, but it is a contribution. We have also tried to support the IMF's, or complement the IMF's assistance to Ukraine with our own macro-financial assistance of almost 2 billion euro. So money is definitely something we try to provide. We try to help stabilize the immediate economic situation, but our support goes far beyond that. It is actually, we're trying to support politically the Minsk process in order to solve at least or come closer to a solution to the current conflict. But I also think that what we are trying to do in implementing the association agreement is one way to support Ukraine, to stabilize it, not only through helping the reforms, but also to creating networks between the EU and Ukraine to, in a way, anchor Ukraine into Europe via a lot of different links, be they economic, be they cultural, be they student links, be they political links. So it's an attempt to really anchor Ukraine on a lot of different levels to the European Union. And, by the way, coming back to the trade war, which is fought in parallel to the military war, which is true, I think our analysis is the exact same. What we have tried to at least mitigate some of this, we have unilaterally already opened our markets, even though, as many of you may know, the trade part of the agreement is still not actually applied because of Russia's opposition and threat that if this agreement would be applied in full, they would actually cancel all trade preferences with Ukraine. So we have tried to do our bit. We are working on the liberalization of the visa regime, which of course is a very sensitive issue for the EU. Not always something we can be proud of, but it is a difficult area. But we are moving closer to a situation where Ukrainians will be able to travel to the EU without actually getting a visa. So that's our approach. We do it on all levels. It's a technical approach. It's a technocratic approach. Essentially, for many, it is not political enough. For many, it is not enough money. But it is, we are trying to use the instruments at our disposal to do what we can. And of course, we do that, first of all, out of our own interest. There's not only, it's not only altruism which motivates the EU. It is obvious that the EU has an interest to have a stable Ukraine, to have a democratic Ukraine, to be able to have, to avoid the crisis to get even worse. That is in our very own interest, be it out of energy security, overall heart security, etc. But it's also we have a certain responsibility, not least because the EU has been a model or a symbol or a guiding force in this process of transformation. This is in the end about the values we always say we want to promote through our policy, the one we think we have towards our Eastern partners, the Eastern Partnership. This is the transformation we want to achieve, not only in Ukraine, also in some of the other countries in the region. So we do, we are in this, and we have to try to do our best to do that. Now, of course, the challenge we all face now, and I'm sure that Sergei will have more to say on that, is how do we move from demanding the change, doing the legal changes necessary, which the Parliament really works hard on doing, to actually implement and to make change happen, that people see changes in their lives they also perceive as positive. And on this point, I think we're at the moment in a rather almost dangerous situation, because if you look at the most recent surveys on the attitude of the Ukrainian population towards reforms, it is, for obvious reasons, getting far more pessimistic. First of all, Ukrainians are more aware about reforms today than they were some time ago. However, an increasing share of Ukrainians actually thinks these reforms will be harmful to them, which is understandable. They're in the midst of a severe economic crisis. They see every indicator in their personal lives in terms of income, in terms of income security, in terms of pensions go down. So obviously their perception is of this being a rather harmful process. Less and less people believe that in the end reforms will actually lead to the positive changes they were hoping for and they were demanding. And also, fewer and fewer people understand the actual need behind some of the reforms. I think there is probably a clear, and then there's an additional risk, which I also seen, which is mentioned in one of the chapters of this book, which I think is very, very important to keep in mind. The kind of reforms we, as the EU, or the West in general, or the international financial institutions, are discussing with the government, are pushing the government to do, are not necessarily the same priorities the population has. We are talking about anti-corruption. This is probably where we match the priorities of the population. But we're also talking about deregulation. We're talking about a whole range of rather possibly obscure legal and technical changes, which are very important. But what is the priority of people in Ukraine today? It's beyond their personal security. It's healthcare. It is pensions. It is the inflation. And it is a certain stability in the exchange rate for them to not lose even more money that they already have done. And I do see that there is an increasing gap in the view or in the perception of what people think the government should be doing and what maybe we as partners think the government should be doing in order to stabilize the country and put it on a different and more promising path. So that is a risk which I think we have to manage beyond the overall geostrategic risk. Carefully in order to not lose again Ukrainians along the way, which I think has happened before and which will in the end mean that this process will not lead to the outcome we are hoping to see. And for that very reason, I would also personally warn, and I'm ending on this point, we should also not see our support to Ukraine purely through the geopolitical lens. We should not see this purely, again, coming back to where I started, as a means to address the big geopolitical questions we are facing towards Russia, towards the region, which I don't say are not there, but if we do that, we again reduce the wishes, the fate, the prospect of Ukrainians to an object of the debate. It has to first of all happen for its own sake, and then we also have to make sure that this also leads to a improvement in the geopolitical situation. And I end on this point. Yeah,
thank you very much. Actually, it's a nice transition to Serhii's talk, because one of the final points you made was about what is it that Ukrainian people actually want, and that nicely transitions us to our final speaker, who will be focusing on kind of more on the domestic aspects of the crisis and policy and politics.
Good evening. Thank you for your interest, and thank you for coming on our discussion. I used to be a journalist, and now I'm trying to be a parliamentarian. There are 6 months since I was elected, and I'm a member of anti-corruption committee in parliament, so we are focused more about anti-corruption issues. But let's discuss general situation in Ukraine. I think Ukraine faces at least three challenges now. The first challenge is clear. It is war and economic crisis. I think this is a really battle for Ukrainian future now on the east. I think clear for you and for me that goal of Putin is not to establish independent Donetsk People's Republic or Lugansk People's Republic. The goal of Putin is to use these fake republics as a destabilizing institution inside of Ukrainian body, and to stop any attempts of Ukrainian-European integration. And the war on the east also reflect on the general situation in Ukraine, and you know, the numbers are not very optimistic, but I hope in short perspective Ukrainian economy will recover. A second challenge, I think, is a populism and radicalization of society. And we have radical party in parliament, which is the leading populist party, but also some liberal or conservative parties also sometimes involved in populism steps, like anti-communism laws adopted a few months ago, or the special law to exchange dollars loan on unmarked course, and even bloc of Petro Poroshenko sometimes votes for this populistic step, because it's now fashionable in Ukrainian politics to be populist. And on other side of this process is radicalization of society. This is typical for situation which Ukraine is faces now. I mean war and economic crisis. It was happened before in history of Europe. It is happening now in Ukraine. But I think, I hope we will not go long way on this path. And third challenge for Ukraine now is corruption and oligarchs. And I would like to speak more about this issue, because it's focus of my interest in parliament. We are trying to do our best, at least, to limit oligarchs' influence and to fix some areas where corruption is well developed in Ukraine. I'm not going to be advocate of current leadership of Ukraine, but I have to stress that sometimes Western audience and people in Ukraine underestimate measures which were done and which are going to be done in short perspective. I think general mood in society because of war reflect on the estimation what is going on inside. Because if Ukrainian economy demonstrated growth, I think general evaluation of processes in Ukraine would be more optimistic. And what was done by Ukrainian parliament during last months? First, anti-corruption bureau law was adopted, and this anti-corruption bureau are gonna to start the activity in short perspective in few months. And thanks for Western leaders, thanks for the international community, which pushed Ukrainian leaders to adopt this law and to establish independent new investigative body, which are gonna be focused on top level corruption in Ukraine. The second measure which was done by Ukrainian parliament during last months in sense of limit of oligarchs' interest is starting of public broadcasting. We adopted some amendments, and public broadcasting could first share independent views among people, and second, influence on oligarchs' media. Just because if people see independent coverage of process in Ukraine on public channel, I think it will reflect on biased oligarchs' media in covering of Ukrainian events. During last months, we opened a lot of public records and registers in Ukraine. Now in Ukraine, everybody can open special website and to check who is the final owner of this or that company. As former journalist, I understand how important this measure is. Just because I published dozens of articles about corruption, about schemes, and very often it was no official information who is behind this or that company. Of course, it will not fix corruption at all, but at least it will make life of journalists, easy to find out what this company is, who is this company behind, who is that company behind. And we're not gonna stop on this. We are gonna open some new registers in Ukraine, like register of car owners. And I think in short perspective, Ukraine gonna be one of the most transparent country in sense of registers, at least in this area. But I think one of the strongest challenge is how to deal with oligarchs and how to limit their influence in Ukraine. Of course, we can attack one oligarch, another oligarch. We can resign Kolomoyskin from the position of governor. We can resign Palitsa. We can resign Nalivaychenko. But it will limit oligarchs' influence for very short distance, and they will recover. And I think the most important is not to attack personal this or that oligarch, but to establish institutional measures to limit their influence. Why they are so influential? Because they influence on politicians, they influence on media, they influence on regional elites, they influence on network in society, like football fans, like criminals. So the area of oligarch's influence is very spread. And to limit the influence, we have to establish at least few institutional measures. And of course, we will not win in this battle during one or day or even 1 year. But there is no alternative way. I think very crucial is to start public financing of political parties. This is a system which works all over the Europe, at least in continental Europe. And the Ukrainian parliament, I hope, will adopt this law in short perspective. And I'm optimistic not just because I was head of working group to prepare this law, but also because this law is a part of conditionalities of European Union for free visa regime and for 1.8 billion euros loan. And I have to say that if we put something in conditionalities of international support or in the conditionalities of free visa regime, it push process to go much faster. And I think there is no way to avoid this law or that law if we put something in conditionalities. Also, how to limit oligarchs' interests? They are very influential in media sphere. And first, we have to adopt media transparency law. We have to understand who is the owner of this or that channel. We know who is the owner of 1+1, Mr. Kolomoyskyi. But if we go to the register, there is no name of Kolomoyskyi among final owners. If we go to the list of shareholders on interchannel, there is no name of Firtash. And we have to go through Georgian experience. They first adopt the law of media transparency, then they adopt the law of media financing transparency. And it influenced on the general media situation in Georgia, and I hope it will influence in situation with media in Ukraine. So first we have to be sure which clan is behind of this or that media, then we have to use anti-monopoly laws to limit their influence. Because now the whole Ukrainian TV market is divided between four main players, and all these players are oligarchs: Mr. Kolomoisky, Mr. Firtash with Mr. Levochkin, Mr. Akhmetov, and Mr. Pinchuk. And I think it's not the normal situation for European country. Then I think another anti-oligarch measure could be ban of political advertisement on private TV channels. Why I'm so confident? Because Ukrainian political process is the competition of pockets. You know, during last campaign, 1 minute of TV advertisement on channel STB cost about $20,000 per minute, but each party bought hours of TV advertisement during the campaign. And the question, how money came to the pockets of parties? By oligarchs. And some oligarchs were even smarter than we think. They did not pay money to politicians. They proposed some discounts for political leaders of some parties and put their people in the list of these parties. So they didn't even spend any, you know, dollar for political campaigns. They just used their media as a tool of influence on political process in Ukraine. So if we ban political advertisement, I think it will reflect on the influence of oligarchs. And you could ask how people will know which platform of this or that party. I think political advertisement could be free of charge on public broadcasting. This is a system which works also in European countries. And of course, anti-monopoly committee is very important for limit of oligarchs' interest in different area of economy, especially on energy market. And I forget another measure, it's a new election law. The parliament which is working now in Ukraine was elected on old election system, and unfortunately a lot of people just bought their places in parliament. I was evidence of this process, because during the last 10 days of campaign, me and my colleagues, we spent in one of constituencies in very depressive region of Ukraine, and we saw how one of the candidate, former secretary of Kiev City Council, just bought the votes, you know, paying people 200 hryvnias. At that time it was less than $20 per vote. And it was very depressive, and I think it's crucial to change the process, to change the tradition in Ukrainian politics, to change the electoral law. And the local elections are going to be on new electoral basis. It's going to be combination of majoritarian and open list system. Unfortunately, parliament did not vote for completely open list system, but I hope for parliamentary election we will change the law completely. And you can also ask, am I optimist or not? I think I'm optimist, because we have completely another situation than it was 3, 5, 10 years ago. Because previous Ukrainian presidents, like Mr. Yanukovych, Mr. Yushchenko, Mr. Kuchma, they used their geopolitical position to trade between Moscow and Brussels, or between Moscow and Washington. They came to Moscow saying, give me cheap loan or I will integrate Ukraine to Europe. And then they came to Brussels and said, give me free visa regime or we will join customs union. The same with Washington. Current president cannot go to Moscow and ask for money support. They can only choose between two options. First, it's European integration with a full package of reforms. And second is, I called it Latin Americanization of Ukraine, yes. When default depression, economic recovery, default depression will change with some period of time. And I think in this situation, I'm also optimist, because we can combine effort of European institutions, of IMF, of Western donors of Ukraine, efforts of Ukrainian civil society, and efforts of members of parliament to change situation in Ukraine, to push reform process. And the only way how to do with current problems, I think, is money after reforms. So I think Western donors should not pay Ukraine without conditionalities, without progress in reforming process. And as I see it from inside, if we put something in conditionalities, this is the best engine for reforming process. And I hope Ukraine will be effective on this path and will recover after dramatic events which happened during last year and a half. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, excellent way to end and start the Q&A session, because let's remind ourselves that the topic of the panel today is what is it that Ukraine want and need from the EU. So it's a very nice way of opening up the discussion. I'll perhaps collect a couple of questions. Gentlemen here and then here, please.
No microphones.
No microphones.
Charles,
oh, there is a microphone, sorry.
Thank you. Charles Grant from the Centre for European Reform. A couple of related, very quick questions. When I was part of an ECFR study trip to Ukraine about 2 months ago, we were told in the finance ministry that the financing needs would be 40 billion euros, or dollars, I'm not sure which, over 5 years, and that the IMF were giving 17 and a half, the restructuring of the debt would give about 15, and bilateral aid would give about 7 or 8, and that would be enough. But I wondered, is that really enough? Because I picked up on a recent visit to Berlin a very strong worry that Ukraine's going to run out of money soon. And people in the Chancellery in Berlin said, look, we're very worried. Putin just has to sit back and wait. If he waits, Ukraine will run out of money, it'll default, that'll create economic turmoil, that'll create political chaos, and then in the long run, a new government will be installed more sympathetic to Russia. That's my worry. So I wonder if am I being too pessimistic, Sergei? And a related very quick point, the DCFTA, the Deep and Comprehensive Free Trade Agreement, I mean, is it really going to be implemented at the end of the year? Because, you know, last time it should have been implemented, Russian pressure on the EU, on Ukraine, made people postpone its implementation. I gather some interests in Ukraine didn't want it implemented either. So is it really going to be implemented? And what really would be the effect if it is implemented? That question, I guess, is for Ulrika. Thank you.
Presentations.
Yeah.
My name's Ewan Grant. I'm the former Customs and Excise Intelligence Analyst for the ex-Soviet Union, and I have worked in Ukraine and other ex-Soviet countries, never Russia. My question is for Ms. Hauer and Mr. Leschenko, although I strongly endorse many of the bullet points in Mr. Wilson's presentation, particularly about the need to take account of the trade war and how early that started, and also a much need to emphasize EU-US cooperation. For Mr. Leschenko, how is there an opportunity for Ukraine to use the oligarchs to sort of wipe the slate clean with them, provided you get at least some of the money back, given their significant control over the economy? And perhaps not so much a question, maybe more a comment for Ms. Hauer. What about recognizing in money and assistance in return for cooperation, Ukraine's ability to help the EU on a number of international criminality issues? Frankly, I was very concerned about how the political and criminal problems facing Ukraine were sometimes, not always, viewed in EU member states and in certain elements of Europol purely from the viewpoint of EU member states. I'm not saying that was a collective EU view. Frankly, the issue of cooperation, and I had this from a senior person in Europol, the issue of cooperation on these issues should surely be looked at from at least a political viewpoint, because Ukraine's at war.
Thank you. Any other, maybe a third question before we give the panelists a chance to respond? Okay, so I think we've got two. There was another one. Yeah, the gentleman here.
Thank you. What's been done to help Ukrainian businesses understand EU regulations and comply with them?
Okay. Thank you. Yeah. So you can just answer the questions in the order they were asked.
Should I start?
Who would like to answer the first one? Yeah.
So European side should answer the question about debt of Ukrainian economy and loans.
Well, I mean,
you are more in charge of money, we are more in charge of debts.
To be honest, I do not know if 40 billion is indeed still a realistic figure. I would feel very uneasy now making predictions. I'm not familiar. I think we all know that even when we count everything up, what we have, the IMF, the debt restructuring, what the EU has put on the table and other bilateral donors, we don't even yet quite reach the 40 billion. So I think even if we don't go into the even higher figures, it's already a situation where we still need to work on finding solutions. Is this going to be the end by we all, Mr. Putin just leans back and Ukraine defaults and then it all falls back into his fold? Well, I hope not, because I do hope, and this is, I'm trying not to sound too naive, but I do hope that in the meantime, the process which has started domestically, which is a different political culture, has maybe made it at least much more difficult to fall back into the what we have seen in years before, exactly the process you have described. But I don't want to make predictions on the exact financing need. I think we got it wrong in Greece each time we tried, so I wouldn't dare to do it on anything. On the DCFTA, well, once again, we are very firmly, and I think we, the EU, in each formal document we managed to, we have put in the 1st of January 2016 as the starting date of the implementation of the DCFTA. I again, given the way the situation in Ukraine has developed over the last 18 months, and unfortunately not always to the better, I dare not make firm predictions on this is actually going to happen, because who knows? We have predicted so many things, but we are firmly and definitely sticking to this date. We're doing everything in order to make it possible to start the implementation. Now, what will the effect be? As I said before, in de facto, the EU is unilaterally applying all the trade preferences towards Ukraine under the DCFTA. So in terms of market opening, let's say the classical tariff reduction, we're doing that. So Ukraine benefits from the trade preferences we have. And as I said also before, we do try to kind of mitigate a little bit of the effects of the loss of market share for Ukrainian exporters in Russia. The problem, of course, is it's not always a simple tariff issue, because we know that products which may be competitive or able to enter the Russian market are just simply not yet, at least, competitive on the European market. So even with the best of all preferences, the market may not respond in order to really make all the difference. The big effect for Ukraine by implementing the DCFTA will, of course, once again, I come back to my main theme, will be the reforms they will have to do. Because as I said, we open the market. Ukraine has, in any case, a relatively long transition period, so they have a very gradual market opening agreed towards EU exports to Ukraine. But the big changes will be in the change of the legal regulatory system, be it now on production, be it on sanitary standards for food products. This is where the bulk of the work will have to happen. This is where the difficult reforms will be. And that brings me to the very last question. What do we actually do to help Ukrainian businesses to understand what's coming and how they will have to adapt to a completely different market situation? That's what we try to do via our financial technical assistance. We have relatively large facilities, what we call exactly the DCFTA facilities, which helps the adjustment, which tries to also target SMEs in particular to be able to adjust and not to go under, but actually benefit from the situation. if it will work, we will see once it actually happens. But it is something we're very aware of. And what we're also trying to address, the EU is never good at any of this, but we have to communicate better. And of course, we have to communicate, we have to explain, we have to be able to actually make sure that people understand, and that we have to do together with the Ukrainian authorities. And I think that's definitely something we still need to improve our efforts. I think that was all for me. I'm sorry, I really didn't quite get your question, but probably because I'm everything but an expert on Europol and any of these issues, so I'm not sure I dare to even react to it.
Perhaps the other panelists would
Me too, the same.
I can add a little bit about economics. I think there are at least three reasons for fearing that the maths may be out of date. One is obvious, that the GDP collapse has been worse than feared. But within those figures, the export collapse has been worse than feared. Secondly, the money was described as front-loaded, which it was to a degree, but not to a sufficient degree. So you had a small tranche, only one tranche has been issued, and the second is being talked of right now. Thirdly, it was always slightly bizarrely dependent on this kind of IMF-sanctioned deal with the bondholders, which now seems to be heading towards a denouement involving a 40% haircut, according to recent reports. You may know better. Which will upset many of the other elements in the package, I fear. But in terms of your broader question about Putin, yes, of course. Clearly he is sitting back. The Ukrainian press, the Russian press is full of linkage. The military front is relatively quiet because the economic one looks so bad. Which is bad news if you recover economically.
I will answer the question about DCFTA. In May this year was the meeting. President Poroshenko invited the group of young MPs who are united in caucus called Eurooptimist, and one of the questions was about, is Ukraine going to postpone DCFTA as it happened last year? And Poroshenko stressed a few times that Ukraine will not. So I hope it will start next year.
Thank you. Let us collect another round of questions. The lady here and then the gentleman, yes, if you could pass the microphone. If you could introduce yourself.
Anna Reed, I write about Ukraine. It's a question for Serhii Leshchenko primarily. I interviewed some of your colleagues in the Eurooptimist group a few weeks ago in Kiev, and I was surprised at how little appetite, even amongst them, the most reformist, progressive elements in Parliament, there is for real wholesale de-oligarchization. Nobody seemed to think that either prosecuting these big names or renationalizing their assets was either going to happen or was desirable. And I'm interested to hear, explore with you a bit why you think that's so. My second question is, just how harmful do you think it is, the fact that they have purchased quite a lot of political influence and succeeded in laundering their reputations to quite a large degree here in London and elsewhere in the West? You know, Mr. Firtash is all over the place, Mr. Pinchuk is all over the place, long list of distinguished institutions who've taken their money and, you know, quite influential political figures who are on their payrolls. Do you think this is actually harmful, or do you think it's just a side issue?
Thank you very much indeed. Neil Buckley from the Financial Times. If I maybe make one very quick comment, as Andrew was talking about the financing issues, and Charles Grant as well, our impression covering these talks with creditors is, or rather our best guess would be, that ultimately there'll be some kind of compromise between the Ukrainian government and the creditors on a haircut somewhere between 0 and 40%. But both sides are playing very hard ball indeed, and there's been virtually no substantive engagement directly face-to-face between the principals on this. Importantly, though, the IMF has said it is prepared to disburse the next tranche even if Ukraine imposes a moratorium on debt servicing, which Ukraine has threatened it might do, through a policy they call lending into arrears. So for the moment, the IMF is sticking with Ukraine, but if Ukraine does impose a moratorium, then that will be, in effect, a default and will have big implications for its access to markets in future. My question to Sergei Leshenko, possibly to Andrew as well. Sergei, you talked about one of the challenges being the rise of populist and radical parties. But you also said you hope that Ukraine doesn't go too far down that path. But how big a danger is there in the coming local elections, which are in October, I believe, that the radical and extremist parties could make, or populist parties could make, a big breakthrough? And if they do, how will that play into the broader national political situation?
Thank you. Any more questions? We could take another one before we let the panelists respond. All right, then.
Given the iniquities of English libel law, only Sergei can answer about Ukrainian oligarchs in Britain.
So the first question was about oligarchs, and I would like to say what I think. I think it's very important to limit the influence, and of course, I'm not talking about concentration camp for oligarchs somewhere in depressive region of Ukraine. I think about institutional measures. Because if we put one oligarch in prison, no guarantee that in few weeks or few months another one will grow up at the same segment of economy. And much more important just to try to limit the influence through state budget financing, media demonopolization, public broadcasting, ban of political detainment, and so on and so forth. We can discuss a lot of measures, but I hope at least few of them are going to be implemented. I don't know why another colleagues not so focused on this, just because maybe they are members of another committees and they have another experience. And much more important is that current Ukrainian leadership is pronouncing every second open remarks that they are pushing de-oligarchization. Another question, is Poroshenko oligarch or not? Does it mean that he's going to de-oligarchize himself? He has some challenges, his personal challenges. He promised during campaign to sell his business, and he has to fulfill this promise. But much more important to remove his influence from media, because he is owner of TV channel, and he never promised to sell TV channel. And this is a bad sign, because I really don't understand. Okay, I understand, but I think it's not a good idea for politicians in Ukraine to have media assets in pockets. And this is a challenge for Poroshenko, and I think he will not sell Fifth Channel, but maybe he will somehow fix problems with selling of his chocolate business. And regarding London as a heaven for Ukrainian oligarchs, you know better than me that they invest money here in politicians, in experts, in think tanks. And Firtash is trying to do now what Pinchuk did 10 years ago. And Pinchuk was successful in this attempt. I don't believe in Firtash successful final of this project, because everybody understands very well who is Firtash. And for instance, just a small example, a few weeks ago there was a meeting in Kyiv former Minister of Finance of Germany, Peer Steinbrück, came to Kiev and he invited me to speak. I was surprised why. He told that Mr. Firtash invited him to be part of the board of this agency to modernize Ukraine. And he would like to discuss, is it a good idea or not? And I told him, of course, it's a bad idea. Nobody is going to consider advices from Mr. Firtash as good advices, in sense everybody in Ukrainian politics understands who is behind of this project. And Mr. Steinbrück resigned from this agency to modernize Ukraine. In a few days, Mr. Verheugen, former European Chancellor of Enlargement, came to Kiev as a part of this project. And he is not going to resign from Firtash project, but I can say that nobody considers advisors from this agency as something serious. And I know some former British politicians also joined this project. And unfortunately, Minister of Culture, Mr. Wittingdale, also part of this. I think I know that Mr. Wittingdale is informed who is Mr. Firtash, but anyway, he decided to join. I think it was a bad idea. And we'll see how it will go on. But again, I think in Ukraine, among leaders, like president, prime minister, nobody are gonna be ally of Firtash in current situation. Firtash is to be friend of Firtash in Ukraine politics means now it's you on the dark side of political process. But of course, the problem is how to stop rising of another oligarchs on the place of retired oligarchs. And Neil, you asked me about rising populism and radicalism. From one side, it's a basis for concerns. But from another side, also, I see on the process from inside, and I see that sometimes it's just a game. So some politicians started to be radicals and populists just because elections are coming, not because this is it is there, you know, in their minds, in their hearts, just because they want to achieve more during the campaign. So it's not like radicalism from the heart. It's radicalism from the pocket, you know. And from another side, the risk is there is some risk. But again, there were some discussions that, for instance, Kolomoisky is going to be very radical, and his party is going to be the real risk for Ukrainian democracy. I remember elections in 1998 when Mr. Lazarenko, former governor of Dnipropetrovsk region, was very popular, very important person in his region, but he achieved only 5% during the campaign just because Dnipropetrovsk region is not the whole Ukraine. So you can be very popular in some region, like former Ministry of Foreign Minister Baloga. He has very he has very strong support in one region, but it doesn't mean that his party is very influential in Ukraine. The same with the radicals. They can be influential in some regions, but in general, Ukrainian picture, I think it's not very big deal. Society is not supporting radicalism and the reducing of support of Lashko party during campaign is another evidence of this.
It's another question how important these elections are, because they're only local. I mean, clearly solidifying local democracy and proper relations with Kiev is part of the bigger picture. That's, I guess, why they're looming more importantly than they otherwise would. Last reputable opinion poll I saw had the Poroshenko bloc on 9% and Yatsenyuk on less than 2%. The really interesting thing was that if you add up the support for all the parties, it was 1/3. Right? So there's a huge potential electorate that either may not vote or would vote for new projects.
So yes, some of these will be real populist, but a lot of them will be fake populist. So already in Kiev, you're starting to see these adverts. They're all decked out in national colours. Movement for reforms, new faces, solidarity Ukraine, which all look like fakes. They're very populist, opposing utility price increases, all that kind of thing, with the suspicion being that certain ancien regime forces are behind them. That's largely in Kiev. In east and south Ukraine, you've got an even deeper pit, because turnout was so low in the last election. There is possibility for new parties, fake parties there as well, which wouldn't be decked in national colours. They'd be fake versions of something else.
Thank you. Can I use this opportunity to also ask a question, first to Ulrike and then to Serhii? Ulrike, you gave us a very nice, a very interesting picture about the kind of the ball is rolling, the in terms of Europeanization processes that are already going on. On the other hand, we know that within Ukraine, on the other hand, we know that the prospects of actual EU membership are quite sort of elusive and far away. As you mentioned, there are certain costs that this harmonization in kind of entails for the people actually on the ground, and I'm familiar with that, being a consultant on the Committee of the Regions project. They are very much already involved in, you know, that harmonization of legislation in terms of local governance laws, etc. So the ball is clearly rolling. On the other hand, the carrot of membership is kind of very far away and very elusive. How does the EU deal with this kind of potential for perhaps resentments building in and some kind of a Turkey syndrome of, you know, that elusive goal of membership not quite being concrete, or in terms of the timeline and the potential frustrations among Ukrainian people? And also I wonder whether that somehow ties to this radicalization, some of the other issues that were mentioned in some of the questions. And to Serhii and perhaps Andrew, just a quick question about how the appointment of Saakashvili as a governor is perceived. I know I'm not an expert on Ukraine by any means, but I do follow the Russian press, and certainly the Russian press has used that as an opportunity to kind of launch its propaganda machine and whole smear it and criticize it, both on the security grounds and that, you know, he's a governor of a region that's close to Transnistria, and that creates all kinds of, you know, it's kind of a dangerous scenario in terms of how it is perceived in Russia, but also the fact that he's fleeing, quote unquote, fleeing persecution in Georgia. So this is how the Russian media has that, the aspect that the Russian media have highlighted. So I just wondered whether you could comment on how that appointment is perceived within Ukraine. Thank you. And maybe a couple more questions. Yes? Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I just wonder, what's the role of identity in tackling crisis in Ukraine? I think to a large extent, Russia is winning at the moment so far, at least in media. It's because at some point, either we have lost our identity or we never had it. Mm. The role of identity in this room, a lot of people said formal institutions. Is there a role for informal institutions? Have we ever departed from Russia? Have we ever departed from that country? That's my question. The role of informal institution and culture. Because oligarchs, they are on the top. But at the end of the day, it's about the society, and it's about the people in certain regions. And again, in that question, what does Ukraine want? You can easily substitute it, what does Kyiv want? But we probably need to talk about what does Lviv want, what does Sumy want, what does Ivano-Frankivsk want. Thank you.
Thank you. And a lady there.
Hi, I'm Joanna Shostak from UCL. Just before the summit in Riga, there was a conference devoted to EU support for media in the six Eastern Partnership countries. And there was a gentleman there from the Commission who promised, I think it was €70 million over a number of years to support independent media across the Eastern Partnership countries. I'd be interested to know from the panelists what you know about what is being done in Ukraine, what will be done in Ukraine, and what should be done in Ukraine in terms of European money sort of going towards or helping independent media, and how that can be done whilst sort of avoiding the risk of geopoliticizing the media. Thank you.
Thank you. So we'll let the panelists respond.
I would like to start with Saakashvili. it is the easiest question because Ukrainian leadership, fortunately, does not care about what Russian propaganda machine is going to say about this nomination and this appointment. Just because it's up to Ukrainian president to appoint governors of regions. Fortunately, now we have a situation when Ukraine can make such nomination without confirmation from Moscow. And I think Saakashvili is the strongest candidate for this position. Odessa region is really difficult region, and there are combination of challenges there, starting from Transnistria border and up to local criminals, some oligarchs, some pro-Russian moods in society, but I think he can do the best its job, and I know that he has a green line from president to do what he thinks is important to achieve, starting from nomination of local prosecutor up to head of local branch of interior, Ministry of Interiors, and it is also a big challenge for Saakashvili to demonstrate that he is still a political figure and he can be successful after 12 years as he was elected in Georgia. And I wish him all the best on this position. And at least this is one of steps which was, you know, fully supported by Ukrainian Facebook audience. You know, Ukrainian Facebook audience is the strongest criticism in Ukraine, and this step was supported by these guys. Regarding role of identity, like what Lviv wants, what Kyiv wants, I think this is more issue of pro-Russian spin doctors to divide Ukrainian society. It started in year 2003 when was idea to nominate Mr. Yanukovych as a candidate on presidency. As you remember, Mr. Yushchenko was a very strong candidate, and to increase support of Yanukovych, the spin doctors of Party of Region were looking for some topics, how to divide society, how to separate Yanukovych from Yushchenko, Yushchenko from Yanukovych, and they chosen the topic of language, the topic of regional identity for this. Fortunately, now the topic of language is not part of national confrontation. We have the whole, even generation of Russian-speaking Ukrainian nationalists. And these people are fighting on the east. They are protecting Ukraine on the east, but this is Russian-speaking people. And I think after Yanukovych left, this issue of language disappeared from all Ukrainian political agenda. Of course, there are some politicians and even some parties who could raise this issue, but more, I think, because of some political populist motivation, not because of this is really crucial for society. And if you go in polls, people don't really care about language. They care about level of life, about corruption, about national security, but topic of language is not dividing Ukrainian society anymore. It is my point of view. And
the question was about identity, not the language. Identity. I came from the northeast here. I work at one of the universities. And in that region, we've got Cumberland sausage. Cumberland sausage, can you imagine it?
That's the northwest. It's different.
In Ukraine, I can cook better Cumberland sausage than this Cumberland sausage when I am in Ukraine. Sorry.
Okay, yes.
Go ahead. Well, insofar as people are correct to observe that Ukraine is becoming relatively more united, relatively more patriotic, and de-emphasizing divisive issues that have been artificially raised in salience in the past, then that's happening at these informal levels, horizontally, more or less. The big problem is with verticality, with political relations, elite masses, institutions, etc. So it's very much happening at that horizontal level. There are 11 chapters in this book, and it couldn't all be on the view from the regions, but that is chapters 4, 5, and 6, one on Dnipropetrovsk, one on Kharkiv. So views from experts native to those cities.
Well, I was hoping to get through the evening without the question of membership perspective, but alas, 10 minutes before the end, here it is. No, it is, of course, the big looming, it's also another white elephant in the room. I think I don't mention any secrets if I say that, of course, the EU has absolutely no position on the question, no common position on the question of a membership perspective of whatever kind for Ukraine or the other Eastern European partners at this point. I mean, this is known and it's obvious, and it will not happen anytime soon. So I don't think, it's in a way, it's a question which doesn't pose itself at the moment for our own domestic reasons. In addition, you mentioned the Turkey syndrome. I think the EU has been careful, for the right or wrong reasons, not to promise this perspective. While Turkey, of course, even entered accession negotiations, and I would argue, I shouldn't say that, but I would argue that at least from parts of our of the EU, these were never really sincere. Whatever that case may be, in Ukraine we haven't made this promise. At the same time, it is looming out there, in particular the government of Ukraine, governments of Ukraine, by the way, this is not an EU issue, keeps, of course, requesting some form of European perspective, which we can't give at the moment. I would think, and I think that's at least the institutions are trying very hard to work on, if Ukraine is able to implement the obligations under the association agreement, and you mentioned you're working on a cost of harmonization, which is there, it would already be a long way towards preparation for any future developments in that area. I personally, that's my very personal impression also from my time being posted in Ukraine, but I remain to be corrected, I don't think that for the popular demand is for membership at this moment. I don't think this is an issue really in the discourse in Ukraine as much as it is maybe on the more elite level between the government and the EU in certain negotiations. It is about change. It's not about membership or not membership, which, by the way, I also think it's dangerous that some opinion polls keep asking, are you currently for membership or are you for membership in the Eurasian Union? Because that is not the right question. This doesn't pose itself at the moment. It can definitely lead to frustration in those among those who do want to see Ukraine enter sooner rather than later. It's something we all have to deal with. Expectations management, I didn't mention it, but I think it's an important aspect we all have to think of whatever we try to achieve with Ukraine. It's also being honest instead of trying to pretend in order to not raise the wrong expectations. I personally don't think that this particular aspect contributes to radicalization. Radicalization, in my view, and I've heard a very interesting presentation lately, is more linked to an increasing militarization and more conflict being present in the society. And we shouldn't forget there's more than 1 million IDPs at the moment. Mm-hmm. which means more and more people all over Ukraine are actually feeling the effects of conflict and of violent conflict, and I think that is a much bigger risk for radicalization of the population than disappointed expectations as regards EU membership. On the media question, I know that we've announced a big program for media for all the Eastern Partnership countries. Currently, of course, we have a lot of support more to civil society organizations in Ukraine. Media as such, I don't think receives direct support yet. We have, policy-wise, we have always strongly advocated the establishment of a true public broadcaster in order to change the media landscape, which Sergei so aptly described. We would probably also very much share his assessment of the risks associated with the ownership of media or concentration of ownership of media in the hands of a few oligarchs, including the president. But this is, of course, a process which Ukraine has to find its own answer to. We have advocated a public broadcaster, and yes, in the future we will also try to then support the independent media, which is clearly underrepresented. Even though I have to say I'm personally impressed by the level of debate and the liveliness in the independent media, in particular on the internet-based media in Ukraine. So I think it's not all negative at the moment.
Yeah, but TV is so important. Yeah, there are some numbers which are stable maybe during the last 5 years. 80% of Ukrainian people use TV as a main channel of information, and 40 use internet as a second source of information. So it's so important to deal with TV if we want to have changes in deoligarchization.
Thank you very much. Andrew, did you want to?
Not on me.
Okay, I think, unless there is one final quick question, I think, any quick questions? Yes, please, and then we will wrap up.
Hi, Sergei. My name is Evgen. I'm probably introducing the Facebook Skeptic Society in Ukraine. So
finally, I see these people. Yeah.
The question is, who is, in your opinion, is going to show an example of good practice of doing reforms in Ukraine? So I feel like everybody is waiting, and European Union is waiting, and Ukrainian society is waiting, and people is waiting for some good practice, introduction by an example, that this guy is good, he did something good, he started doing something. So maybe Mr. Poroshenko, Mr. President, is gonna be the person who show how to deal with the problems, probably how to sell the business of chocolate business, and all other oligarchs will say, oh, right, this is a good example. Probably we'll do something better from our side. Thank you.
But frankly, I don't understand the question. Or it was just the statement. As a skeptic Ukrainian Facebook audience likes to do.
The question is, who is, in your opinion, going to be the person or, I don't know, some personality or official from Ukrainian politics who will show the good example?
What is the skeptical part of the Facebook?
The skeptical part is that everybody is waiting and nobody is showing the good example for 1 year and a half already.
Anybody wants to? And a last question, yes?
I wondered if you could talk a little bit more, please, about how much the EU can or should influence Ukraine's conduct in the conflict and seek to manage confrontational, what might be called confrontational moves, such as Saakashvili's nomination in Odessa. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So two, I think especially the second one is quite a complex question, but maybe a couple of minutes to each of the panelists to respond or make some final comments.
I will start with skeptic Ukrainian Facebook audience. From one side, of course, I agree that estimation, you know, we are all hostage of our estimations. And all of us, we are looking for something better. And I can just, okay, if you want to see a skeptical politician, I can play this role as well. But I don't think that it is the reason why you come here. Because if we want to share our skepticism, we can do it through Facebook, and there is no sense to meet and to discuss. We have to do what is in agenda, and my role now is not just to criticize. And frankly, a lot of things make me pessimistic or demotivated. And sometimes politics from inside is even worse than you can imagine looking on the process from outside. But from another side, I understand that, you know, nobody will provide us the second chance. If you believe that after election, even if it happens this year, but maybe next year, preterm parliamentary elections, I can say that situation is going to be worse. And Ukrainian fatigue in Europe could be, you know, the worst background for such elections. So the only way for Ukrainian politics to be effective is to do as much as they can now. And I believe sometimes we just, you know, want to have simple answers on very difficult questions. And for instance, today we are discussing every day about corruption in police, and this is really the ground for unsatisfaction in society. But in few weeks, one experiment will start. It is new police in Kyiv. And this could be, you know, example of some changes, but the result of this, everybody in not even everybody, but citizens of Kyiv will feel, you know, not even tomorrow or even in 1 month. It will take few months or even year, you know. It's very easy to say, like in Georgia it happened, but we are just discussing the result of reforms which took place in Georgia. We are not discussing the process of reforms. In Georgia, it also took a lot of time, and sometimes it was very difficult to achieve something. But from another side, if we are discussing about Georgia, we have to understand that in Georgia, it was made using some autocratic measures. In Ukraine, fortunately or unfortunately, there is a democratic process. And to achieve something in this parliament is very difficult. And I can describe you the eyes of Ukrainian Minister of Finance, Ms. Yereska. She was almost crying in the end of last sitting in parliament on Thursday when she said that parliament did not adopt few very important draft laws for IMF support, the laws which in IMF package. And she does not understand how to deal with this parliament, how to deal with these politicians, because part of parliament is motivated just by corruption, by personal enrichment, by populism, by their personal political future. And this part of parliament do not care about Ukrainian future. So they like Ukraine inside of, you know, their political career. They don't like Ukraine in general. And of course, what is another alternative? Fortunately or unfortunately again, but we do not have another alternative. We cannot establish in Ukraine like dictatorship to have fast result during few weeks. Or we cannot establish in Ukraine like Singaporean experience, like what happened in Singapore. We have to implement very clear European measures, and to achieve some benchmarks in different roadmaps. But result of this will be clear for us, for Ukrainian skeptical Facebook users, not in 1 week and even in 1 month. And the same like with corruption. You know, anti-corruption bureau is in process of establishing. There are only 3 persons in staff of this bureau, head and 2 deputies. But society sometimes do not understand this and criticize and saying anti-corruption bureau is doing nothing. But it will start to work only in a few months. And let's discuss the effectiveness of this maybe in the end of the year or in spring.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thank you.
Just very briefly,
There's very little, I think, I can add to what Zegit just said. I didn't get the first part of the military question. On the second part, the EU hasn't commented on the appointment of Mr. Saakashvili as governor, and I don't think we will. This is a domestic decision, and we will all be looking forward to the hopefully positive effects in terms of changes also in Odessa, but we have no view on that. I think what Sergei just said, I think we should appreciate that this is a democratic process. It's worth so much in itself, and it will have its backs and forwards and lefts and rights, and it will not be as quick as people want it to be, neither in Ukraine nor probably among the partners. But it's the only chance we all have together, and the EU will just have to have strategic patience and stick with it. Because, as I said at some point, it is in our very, very own immediate interest to make sure or to try to support a process which makes Ukraine succeed in its efforts. We have no other option. There's no alternative to it. So all we can do is stick to it.
Andrew?
It's rather depressing that so many people in the West, their first reaction on Saakashvili's appointment was, how will Russia react? My initial reaction was, wow, will that work? You know, and he had some success in cleaning up another Black Sea port, Ajara, over the sea from Odessa. But the circumstances are very different. In Ajara, you had one oligarch, who Mr. Abashidze, who was immediately forced out of town. Whereas in Odessa, you have this kind of collective but divided oligarchy. My worry is that, as in any similar situation, if you send in a good cop to clean up a city, you don't send him on his own. Right, and I'm not sure if his team is big enough to back him up.
I should say that in posing that question, I was by no means endorsing the Russian version of this commentary and this appointment. That's why I use the word propaganda. But I was curious precisely because it would just be interesting to see how the reaction is. Would it be positive in terms of appointing somebody from outside and somebody who would sweep with a new broom? So this was my question, was geared at gauging what the domestic opinion in Ukraine was. But thank you very much for the 3 panelists for a very, very interesting and stimulating discussion, and the audience as well for asking very good and informed questions. And let's give our first guest.